But when kids, unfortunately, are struggling, the first thing that they usually have access to is alcohol, or and then marijuana, because they're getting whatever is legal in their home. And I believe that we need to be able to support families in particular to offer options for their kids when they're struggling with addictions. Oh, I will move this bill now. If it doesn't pass, I will move it again, and I will move it again, and I will move it again until we are able to finally recognize that the beer and wine industry needs to be held accountable, and they need to pony up because, again, almost 50 years since that tax has been raised.
House Bill 2069 is the tribal consultation extension.
So I passed, I think it was 23, the original tribal consultation legislation. And what that is that, as you know, of course, tribes are sovereign nations. And in the state of Oregon, we have 9 federally recognized tribes who interact with state agencies all the time. Now, already, state agencies are required to engage with tribes when they are making decisions that will affect the tribes in some way, shape, or form. Very often, though, we have a person or a group of people within a state agency who understand that and will go ahead and do that work. In some state agencies, or depending on the state agency, when maybe there's turnover or something, someone doesn't understand that. And they go ahead and make a decision or try to do something without consulting with the tribes because they either don't know how or don't believe it's required or don't think, you know, that it's necessary. And that causes a bit of a problem. So what the bill for tribal consultation extension is follow-up from the original one, which is, again, my bill was about a study with the tribes to actually work with them to be clear about what it is they expect from state agencies. Now, Senate Bill 770 was passed a long, long time ago. I can't give you the exact date on that, but that was the original bill that required that tribal consultation. And some agencies do it well and some do not. So what we're trying to do is sort of firm that up. And this is the extension of that original legislation because it took longer than we had anticipated to pull these things together. So we're simply extending the timeline for the consultation process to happen so that the tribes can have more time to work out what it is they expect from the state agencies, what they expect from themselves in order to be able to do this work.
We talked about all of your wonderful accomplishments. Before going down to Salem, what are you most proud of as a legislator?
Embedding the Indian Child Welfare Act into Oregon's statute. That was the most valuable thing, I think, hopefully not the most valuable thing that I will ever do, but right now for Indian Country, that and passing the tax for 988. So 988, of course, is that ability for people to call when they're struggling and in crisis and being able to put even that minor bit of money as a tax on cell phones so that there would be somebody on the line to call when you're struggling.
Representative Tana Sanchez, thank you so much and all the best during this 2025 legislative session.
Thank you.
This is Prison Pipeline, produced at the studios of KBOO Portland. Listen to this and previous Prison Pipeline programs at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. Like Prison Pipeline on Facebook. Thank you to our engineer, and thank you for listening.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland, 90.7 on your FM dial.
This is KBOO Portland. From its founding, KBOO's purpose has been to serve as a community-driven alternative to mainstream media. In a new year, with numerous executive orders from a new presidential administration and the rise of misinformation, KBOO affirms its duty to serve its community. KBOO, its programmers, volunteers, and staff do this by bringing you accurate information, by giving space to underrepresented voices, and by uplifting arts and culture. In these uncertain times, KBOO seeks to be a guiding light for those who are scared, those who are affected, and those who are fighting the good fight. KBOO stands with the immigrant community, the LGBTQIA+ community, the disability community, and all of those affected by the new administration. We stand here at 90.7 FM in Portland, 104.3 FM in the Corvallis-Philomath area, 91.9 FM in Hood River, and at kboo.fm.
This radio show contains graphic descriptions of violence, occasional use of the N-word, and other content that some people may find disturbing or offensive.
This radio show was produced at KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon.
I had joined the Coalition for Human Dignity. It was something that I was interested in as a Jew and wanted to help with. So 2 weeks after I had joined, nothing was purposeful on this at all. But what happened was my daughter and two of her friends were coming home along Southeast 39. They were between Hawthorne and Alder. And a truckload of skinheads went by, about seven of them, some in the back and some in the front, and they were doing Sieg Heils, shouting Nazi slogans.
Carloads of Nazi boneheads would drive around and look for people to attack. They were driving along Hawthorne Boulevard. A young woman and two men were walking along Hawthorne. One of the Nazi boneheads gave a Nazi salute. One of the teenagers flipped them off with both fingers, you know. They grabbed their baseball bats and chased them for blocks.
So they took off running, and the skinheads followed them and started chasing them with baseball bats, 2x4s. Luckily, my daughter knocked on someone's door. She screamed, "Help us, please." Thank God, the woman, Mary Steiger, an 80-year-old woman, opened the door and let my kids in.
So here are these terrified kids who ran to this house that an older woman said, "Yeah, you can come in here." The truckload of Nazis attacked that household right away, threatened to kill her for not giving up the kids, and bashed in her car.
Later on that night, a group of skinheads went back to Mary Steiger's home and broke all of her lower level windows, yelled death threats at her. This is an 80-some-year-old woman.
She had done the right thing. She had defended and guarded these young kids. A household full of elderly people, fearful for their lives, appealed to the police. Police basically said, "Well, yeah, we can't do anything." So somehow word got back to us, and we said, "Do you want us to sit on your front porch?" And she said, "I want you in my front parlor, wherever you best feel that you can guard my house. I haven't slept since then, because they'll drive by and they'll yell stuff, and I'm completely scared out of my wits." So we did. Some of us said, "Well, we're going to bring whatever is necessary to defend that household." And other people who were pacifists said, "Well, I'll just use my body." And we said, "That's okay." We did not try and tell people, "You must be armed or you must not be armed."
This exchange between Coalition for Human Dignity activists Abby Layton and M. Trelor describes one incident when local boneheads terrorized teenagers and elderly citizens after a minor affront in response to open hate signaling, not an uncommon incident in those times.
Mary Steiger's request that activists sit round the clock in her parlor marked the first time Coalition for Human Dignity activists participated in a support strategy that came to be known as a house defense, or, when they took place at night, a vigil. After that, members of CHD and other community organizations routinely guarded the homes of people who had been threatened or attacked by neo-Nazis.
The willingness of coalition members to show up in response to direct requests for support, to move beyond research and tracking, solidified their commitment to direct action on behalf of the community. These vigils also strengthened bonds between the CHD and other anti-fascist organizations like Skinheads Against Racial Prejudice and Anti-Racist Action. I'm Selena Flores.
And I'm Mike Crenshaw. We're your hosts for It Did Happen Here. In this episode, we focus on defense strategies. The house defenses were not publicized or defined aspects of CHD's parameters. Coalition for Human Dignity Intelligence Czar Jonathan Mazzocchi describes how these house defense projects were organized.
You know, we had community defense projects where we would protect groups, families who were under attack by racist skinheads. And there were a number of those incidents. So part of that community defense project involved having a hotline where people could call in racist activity. And at one point up on Southeast Belmont, there was a family of Vietnamese who were being attacked by racists. We mobilized vigils there to protect them. So here you had anti-racist action with Skinheads Against Racial Prejudice, folks with, you know, a pretty powerful community leader in Donna Redwing. Donna was head of the Lesbian Community Project, who was at many of these early community-based coalition meetings. Some of the anti-racists had weapons, including firearms. So it was this sort of mixing in this coalition of people coming together to a fight against these folks that I think was very unique. Outside of that, perhaps those communities didn't have a lot of interaction, but there they could. So that stuff worked early on because the threat was very local and the threat was a vigilante group, kind of like protecting folks from the Klan. The Coalition for Human Dignity played an important role in that kind of community-based self-defense.
We had put out a public banner as, we're here, we're going to drive these folks out. People started calling us up. We had a physical location that people were living at, so there was a place mail could be received, and we had a phone that we would answer and call people back. I can't stress how important that is, call people back if you're politically organizing. We never took a penny or we never tried to publicize that widely. We felt it had to be done, and the police would not do it. They just would not guard these houses that were under attack, that were under obvious attack. So we did that. We did several others, including when there was an altercation at a convenience store, when the future members of Volksfront jumped and beat almost to death a black man in the Northeast, whose family then appealed to us for defense of their house. Again, we said, well, what do you want us to do? And she said, I want you sleeping in my front room because I'm scared. He was still in the intensive care unit at Emmanuel Hospital during the entire period that we were doing house sitting. He was there for a couple weeks. And people ask her, well, what should we bring? And she said, well, you're going to bring weapons, aren't you? Let's get real. You're going to bring something in case they try and get in. I want you to kill them. She didn't say that. It was clear that that was her attitude. They're going to be here to kill us. I want you to stop them. So Randall Krager went to prison for this. And then while he was in prison, along with some of his comrades, helped form Volksfront.
Volksfront was a white supremacist organization founded in Portland out of the scraps of other Portland racist skinhead groups, including Eastside White Pride. Volksfront disbanded only in 2012 after 18 years of their existence. Their members carried out hate crimes across the region and maintained ties to national and international white neo-Nazi groups. And what happened to the skinheads who chased Abby's daughter and attacked Mary Steger's house and car?
A man named Scott Garrow was the head of this group. We had him arrested with evidence, and we took him to court. We came to court, many of us, with rainbow ribbons and with good witnesses, and he was put in prison for 2.5 years.
Other notable Portland racists sent to prison were the three boneheads who killed Mulugeta Sarah. One died in prison, one disavowed racist politics and disappeared from the public eye, and one is a zealous Trump supporter. Did these incarcerations lead to safety for the community? Were Portland activists just removing boneheads from the city so they could develop racist organizations in the suburbs or across the river in Vancouver, Washington? Or, as M. Treloar noted, in prison?
While imprisoning boneheads may result in a temporary grace period, in the Brotherhood of Prison, racist skinheads have access to recruitment of new members comfortable with criminality and violence. It is well documented that neo-Nazi prisoners have successfully organized national and international racist networks. Anti-fascists in the 1990s, much like today, did not always agree on the best way forward. Much like today, there was no best way forward. For some, locking up a racist skinhead signals a victory. For others, incarceration was just one of many methods of defense and a problematic tactic at best. Jail time kept fascists off the streets and functioned therefore as community support, but most understood it as a temporary fix to systemic problems, problems that increased when attackers and assailants found warm reception behind bars.
Time has also shown how incarceration and gentrification work conveniently together. Efforts to drive the boneheads out of Portland dovetailed neatly with pro-development strategies to remove perceived undesirable elements from the inner city. Prison was, and still is, considered an expedient substitution to the challenge of creating an alternative to the carceral state. As Jonathan Mazzocchi noted earlier, house defense worked because the threat was local, immediate, and well within the ability and skill set of the CHD. The problem was, and continues to be, long-term solutions to the violence of hatred and poverty. Whether that violence is delivered by a fascist kick or by municipal neglect and institutionalized racism.
We have heard one coalition member talk with satisfaction about sending someone off to prison, while others talk about not trusting cops. The argument often came down to a choice between directing personal violence of the body against groups of racists versus marshaling resources to direct institutional violence of the state against fascist individuals. Jonathan Mazzocchi speaks on this directly.
This is from James Baldwin. I do not claim that everyone in prison here is innocent, but I do claim that the law, as it operates, is guilty, and that the prisoners, therefore, are all unjustly imprisoned. The point of that is that we cannot fight the right by using the justice system. We cannot fight them with cops. That does not work. It will never work. It's a flawed system. It's deeply racist and it's deeply classist. And back then, the efforts of the Southern Poverty Law Center to essentially, you know, sue the Klan or to sue the far right were, I think, the least important part of the kind of work that they did, that it was more, you know, fighting death penalty stuff and helping unions organize in the South. The Southern Poverty Law Center had a great deal of programs that were not narrowly focused on fighting the far right and still do.
In 1990, the Southern Poverty Law Center, a national civil rights legal organization, prosecuted white nationalist Tom Metzger. Metzger was a California-based leader in the national neo-Nazi group White Aryan Resistance. Through White Aryan Resistance, Metzger cultivated political relationships with violent skinheads and aggressively recruited kids like Ken Death to a white nationalist agenda, which, it was argued, involved Metzger as an instigator in the death of Mulugeta Seurat.
We had a very contradictory relationship to the Metzger trial, especially Aryan Sharp, but also people in CHD. It was really hard to be around because it was not really central to any of our work and what we organized around. You know, that was sort of stage-managed American justice. Metzger basically fell on his own sword, right? He didn't even hire an attorney. He represented himself. So when the trial came about, there was a great deal of, you know, media around it. But fundamental to it is the trial was theater and really stretched the judicial principles and whatnot. But we didn't really care. For the first time in a while, at least it was bending towards fighting racism. While I could care less that he had resources taken away, and I'm glad that they went from him to the family of Mulugeta Seurat, but to defend the Metzger trial as, I don't know, a principled opposition to the far right is problematic. I don't agree with that.
Portland police have a long history of sheltering white supremacists. When police work hand in hand with fascists in a hierarchical system, the need to organize one's own security becomes a priority. M. Treloar describes this undertaking.
We told the cops at our larger things, like the march of 5,000 people during the trial of Metzger, we don't want you around. We didn't trust them. You know, they're going to do the wrong thing. They're going to not protect us. So we were doing our own house defenses and our own security in advance. There was always that threat of bonehead attack, whether it was armed or unarmed. It was always there in any public thing we did. Those house defenses and members of ARA and Coalition for Human Dignity set those up. That was one of the things that I think made things real for a lot of the members who had not been in direct confrontations. So the violence increased. We were not attempting to ramp things up, but we always said we would defend ourselves in public actions. And we trained 50-plus people in basic self-defense with the help of a martial artist who said that she had talked with some of her comrades in Europe who were dealing with Nazi boneheads and that this was a good thing. So she trained a bunch of our people who then did our own security at events. We were trying to get away from a more macho model of I'm going to get tough, I'm going to get weapons, I'm going to attack these Nazis. That works at a certain level, but it also leads to a bad intra-group dynamic of those are the people who will do the security, those are the people who will have weapons, those are the people who will directly confront the Nazis, and the rest of us will just kind of, you know, do our stuff. That's not a good dynamic. The dynamic we were trying to get, and I won't say we had total success, but we did develop a number of people to feeling, yes, I'm part of the security of this group and I won't back down.
Meet Krista, a young college student from Colorado who was an activist with the Coalition for Human Dignity.
The experience of really confronting violence in the streets the way that many communities of color have was essential. Also, simply outnumbering the bigoted right was a huge thing that happened, and I think it happens over and over, and it's still happening. When the Proud Boys show up, it seems like folks can really count on thousands more folks showing up in resistance. And I think in the long run, that not only helps to confront that movement, but I think it means a tremendous deal for people who are threatened and are unsafe in that context to know and see that there are allies and that there are resistance. When I hear people talk about some of the most painful times around the oppressions they face, it's when they feel like they're standing alone. I remember there was some huge talk about, I can't remember if it was White Aryan Resistance or who was organizing this May Day event and how they were going to have White Workers' Day. And they actually showed up with 50 people maybe, facing off with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of folks there to confront the right. It makes them feel silly. That feeling of power goes away when you just look small, when actually there are so many vibrant and diverse people standing in resistance. That was certainly an important thing that happened at that time.
Here's Jason from ARA.
I'm going to give CHD so much credit, and same with Northwest Communities down in Eugene. There were so many groups that worked with us. Radical Women, Leonard Peltier Support Group, Lesbian Community Project. These were people that wanted nothing to do with violence in a lot of ways, and were really hesitant to put their name in there, but they really knew that it was important and do what they had to do to provide some cover in a lot of ways. But the other part of that was we very much reached out to them and we asked them, how can we do this in a way that doesn't put you at more risk or that actually supports you? That was the big thing that is really lacking and frustrated a lot of mainstream activists and even radical activists. A lot of the things were done with disregard for other people's safety and disregard for the care of what more vulnerable communities needed. I felt that we had done a really freaking good job of that. We really wanted to know what people thought, and then we listened to it, and then we also supported them and said, anytime you need us, we'll come do childcare at your event. We'll come do security happily, but we'll also do whatever else. We'll play music or we'll help with the sound or anything, anything that needs to be done. We also, I think, made a good effort to say, and we'll do it in the way you want us to do it. Do you want us to do it in a way that is very visible? Do you want it to be known that we're there supporting you and we're standing out front of your church that's come under attack for the last month and a half? Or would you rather have us very discreetly inside where no one can see us and we blend in, and out front in cars where no one can see us and we're just there and so that you feel better about it? It made a really strong bond that I still have to this day with a lot of those people. When I run into them in the street or at events, it's really, really cool. CHD was really solid about that. They rode that line really, really well. Jonathan never cared what anyone said about their support of anyone else, and they decided that it was a thing that needed to happen, and they were going to do it. Everyone from that community went all out, and we went all out in their behalf as well.
We certainly helped to really shift the dial around bigots feeling called out, and knowing that even when our police force won't confront them, and I know 30 years later, that's still the struggle, that they're protected. They're protected within the police force. They're protected within municipal government sometimes.
By 1992, the Coalition for Human Dignity was running on all cylinders. They were participating in ongoing house defense, they were doing research, they were gathering intelligence, and they routinely still liaised between the militant anti-racist and various civil and human rights groups in the Portland area. All the while, as M. Treloar says, under continuous threat from fascist attack. These were hard conditions for any group to meet, much less a group with no long-term experience with each other, very little financial support, who made things work as they went along. It comes as no surprise that elements of internal culture suffered from the ceaseless stress, threat, and urgency.
We made lots of mistakes along the way in the way we treated each other, in the way we treated people who just came through the work briefly and then were like, I'm out. This isn't very fun. This isn't very safe. This doesn't feel good. There's not a place for my voice. Sometimes it takes extra work to bring in the folks who aren't like in your social circle or one degree separated from your social circle. And I think in the coalition that tended to be a shortcoming. And other folks might disagree, but I would, and it actually partly came from losing phone numbers when new folks came in. So we tended to fall back on organizing within our social networks at a time where I think not only could the organization have been more powerful and impactful, but also the process that we were working in could have been safer for the people doing it, safer for voices that were often silenced to be heard. That was true about gender, but it was certainly true around race too. It was not a particularly easy place to be, and we all could have worked harder to change that. That would have broadened and deepened impact, and that sense of things being so urgent that there are skinheads out with baseball bats, and there's, you know, that there always felt like there was something that had to happen right then. It was hard to make space, I think, for those discussions about integrating anti-oppression work into the work we were doing. It's hard for people to feel unsafe. We need to take care of each other. That internal work of kindness and of small acts, the way we treat each other individually, is such a big part of us being successful organizers. So I'm super grateful for the things I learned, super sorry for mistakes that I made where I could have been a better ally, I could have been a better group member, but it was certainly like a gritty, messy process. And a lot of really brave things happen, and I think that is something that certainly needs to be honored. And we always have to stop and honor the shoulders of the folks we're standing on and the many brilliant organizers and activists who stand behind us, and many who were never going to know what they did. We're never going to know what their bravery was. We had such brilliant and brave people who had paved the way. And I feel like each round of it, we're part of the work is creating more space, making sure that we bring new and brilliant voices in who really feel safe to speak. And when they need allies who are not in the room, that we go out and we find those allies, and we make sure that we're creating spaces where we have new voices. We haven't won yet. We need more brilliant and committed folks at the table. And it's so great that we have these generations of us now.
Eric Ward is a longtime community activist who helped run CHD's sister organization in Eugene. He moved to Portland in the 90s to work with CHD and other community defense organizations. He has a deep history in racial justice and the fight against white supremacy. Eric Ward is now executive director of the Western States Center.
What does community defense look like? The best way to answer that is to ask yourself, what does community defense feel like? The way that it often feels is joyous, celebratory, empowering, and beautiful. The best way to tell if one has been successful is the feeling that is evoked in them at the end of an action, right? If one feels frustrated, if they feel angry, if they feel grief, it likely means we weren't successful at community defense. If people are able to realize that they've won a victory, demobilize, go home, and allow the entire city to feel what folks on the streets are feeling, that is successful community defense. And it is often a hard place to find, particularly for those who are engaged in direct action. So one of the key lessons we learned in the 90s was to ensure that we were really reflecting the joy that our communities needed to experience on the other side of being challenged by white nationalists who are committed to intimidating vulnerable communities or Portland itself.
Thanks for listening to this episode of It Did Happen Here. The transcripts, show notes with links, full credits, and other relevant content can be found at our website, itdidhappenherepodcast.com. Interviews in this episode were conducted by Annette Newell, Selena Flores, and Aaron Yankee, and your hosts were Selena Flores and Mike Crenshaw. This podcast is produced by Selena, Mike, and me, Aaron Yankee. Thanks to the participants for sharing their stories. Thanks also to the Institute for Anarchist Studies, to PM Press, to the Marla Davis Fund, to KABU Community Radio, and to the rest of our production team, Icky A., Julie Perini, and Mo Baustern. And thank you for listening.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kbu.fm.
This radio show contains graphic descriptions of violence, occasional use of the N-word, and other content that some people may find disturbing or offensive.
This radio show was produced at KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon.
Someone will call us up and say, hey, my friend works at this Pizza Hut, and this Nazi works there, and he's always talking with her. And so we would go to the Pizza Hut. We would wait there, and when they get off work, we'd follow them home and then follow them to another home. And then we'd stake that place out and we'd just start making connections. All of a sudden we had this network. It was all scribbled out on a notepad that had like 20 different addresses on it with the major, major hitters on their side. All the Youth of Hitler guys, Aryan Front, American Front. We had all these people's names and addresses just from following people around because we were patient. Our Friday nights would be, okay, four of us get together and we go sit out in front of my house, drink a couple beers and talk to us and listen to music and, ooh, someone's coming, here they go. Okay, let's follow them to the next house. And then when they're going to try and meet up somewhere, we can dismantle their cars so they can't get there and make it really difficult for them to organize.
This is Jason from Portland's chapter of Anti-Racist Action.
The week before they were all supposed to go to Aryan Nations, we just grab a bunch of Jolly Ranchers and go from house to house to house, putting them in gas tanks so that they all had car trouble and they all had to pay a mechanics bill so that they didn't have as much income to take off for the weekend. We were willing to do a lot of things that a lot of the other groups would not do, or they didn't want to risk the physical scenario, much less getting caught and then having to answer to the police. We are totally willing to do this, and we'll do it so that you don't have to. We made some risky endeavors to get information that was not available. These friendships that were made early on led to, of course, Jonathan calling me up and being like, hey, man, I got to go dig through some trash, and I would really like to have a couple people with me. You got it. Let's go. We had intel on everybody. We were a little obsessed, but we knew it had to be done.
In our last episode, we looked at the house defense work of the Coalition for Human Dignity, where activists discreetly supported Portlanders targeted by white nationalist violence. In this episode, we offer another example of the coalition's dedication to using a diversity of tactics in the fight to drive white nationalist organizing out of Portland.
We'll hear about the far less public side of the Coalition for Human Dignity, digging through trash, following known racist skinheads, and sabotaging vehicles. The CHD also sent undercover agents to white nationalist meetings and gatherings on delicate and dangerous missions. A wall of secrecy existed between the community-based activities of the coalition and their intelligence work. Who are the people who masterminded and took these risks? What did they do with the information they gathered? I'm Mike Crenshaw.
And I'm Selena Flores. We're your hosts for It Did Happen Here, Episode 8, A Research Capacity, Part 1. By the early 1990s, the Coalition for Human Dignity had shrunk in size but sharpened its focus. Within the broad coalition, a core group of anti-racists publicly confronted neo-Nazis in pickets and marches, organized house defenses, and nurtured ties to street-level anti-racist groups like Anti-Racist Action and Skinheads Against Racial Prejudice. Early on, the CHD identified intelligence gathering as a key part of its mission to expel white power racists from the city. They collected reports from citizens who observed neo-Nazi activity in workplaces and neighborhoods. They worked closely with the Homophobic Violence Documentation Project hotline run by the Lesbian Community Project to identify and address hate crimes. And they collected intelligence on the hundreds of neo-Nazi and far-right groups organizing throughout the Pacific Northwest.
A key figure in this intelligence work was Jonathan Mazzocchi. We've heard from him throughout the series. Mazzocchi was a fixture of the Coalition for Human Dignity. Stories place him on the street confronting cops and racists, helping with trainings, organizing large protests. But his passion was digging into the white power movement to learn who they were, where they would be, and how to take them down. Jonathan was a Lewis and Clark student involved in Central American solidarity and socialist politics. His highly principled anti-fascism and detail-oriented approach to fighting the right comes through in his speech, and it's clear that he has the temperament to organize an intelligence operation from the ground up. Jonathan Mazzocchi's comrades and allies speak with great respect of his commitment to the fight against fascism. Right-wing websites to this day post about him with deep hatred.
The Coalition for Human Dignity maintained something called The Shop.
The Shop was the name of the coalition's intelligence headquarters, located in industrial North Portland.
Which was an office that housed 30 filing cabinets full of primary and secondary sources on far-right groups in our area of responsibility, which we took to be the Pacific Northwest. We had a very specialized library of more than 500 volumes. We had hundreds of videotapes and audio tapes, and then we had database full of license plates from when we would send people to events to write down the license plates, and then we'd have to run them through the Oregon DMV. This would take time, and it was very labor intensive. There were, at that time, hundreds of small papers throughout the region that would include in them letters to the editor, stories by beat reporters, so on and so forth. And if you wanted to get those stories, you had to subscribe to a clipping service, which would take, you know, keywords like white supremacist or anti-immigration. So the service would have someone cut out a whole bunch of clippings, put them into a packet, and then mail them to us. And once we would get them weeks later, we would index them and then put them into a database so that we could monitor them and begin to understand what it was they were doing. So my point here is that that's a lot of volunteers, a lot of labor, and it was a very different information environment. So in order for us to be competent, we had to have funding, we had to have support, we had to have people with basic library science skills. So that's what we did. And so this work was carried out by myself and a few other people, and the late Stu Albert, who was a somewhat famous Yippie from the 60s, was instrumental in the Coalition for Human Dignity. He was on our board in training and helping people like me develop these skills with intelligence gathering. Stu died a few years ago. I miss him terribly. But he was a wonderful link also to 1960s radicalism and what was then the contemporary left.
Another key figure in developing the coalition's intelligence work was Leonard Zeskin, author and research director at the coalition's parent institution, the Center for Democratic Renewal. Zeskin is referred to here by Jonathan as Lenny.
It was Lenny's style of organizing a research-driven local unit. That's primarily his idea. Lenny has a better grasp of all of this, I think, than virtually anyone, really anywhere.
And here's Leonard.
This work takes time and energy, and it takes the ability to, if you're developing an informational organization, it takes months. It doesn't take days. It takes months and sometimes years to develop good information. CHD was willing to do it.
National watchdog organizations like the Anti-Defamation League or the Southern Poverty Law Center use the top-down centralized power structure where local groups were guided by a national headquarters. The CHD's intelligence work, on the other hand, worked on building intelligence and community strength from the grassroots of the communities themselves.
We argued that research should be local and should be carried out in local communities by local people. Local communities have it within their power to monitor their own races. It's local people who know best what's going on in their communities in order to knit together all of that research and all of that monitoring. We became a regional source to do that. And that meant training and working with hundreds of people in different communities who were tracking all of these groups.
Here is Stephen Gardner, the coalition's intermittent executive director that we met in episode 3.
Three or four people working full time can't do all of this research. So we trained community researchers, one or two people in each town where there was some kind of activity happening. This ended up being a whole bunch of trainings around the Northwest, basically overviewing the picture of the far right in the Pacific Northwest, what kinds of activities were happening, what communities could do to respond. We were always big believers in informing your community who might target your community, what kinds of ideas, what kinds of ideologies, what kinds of tactics before there was a high-profile hate crime or a march that made the press or something like that.
Again, Jonathan Mazzocchi.
Because the far right was a social movement, and by that we meant it wasn't part of the state. Most of these people were organizing outside of government. They were in citizens groups, grassroots, far-right organizations. Because they were organized in that fashion, it gave us a unique opportunity. We did training sessions to develop skills to research the far-right, and some of that research involved infiltrating them, sending people to meetings. We called this broadly having a research capacity or an intelligence capacity.
What did infiltration look like for the Coalition for Human Dignity? For some, it meant going deep undercover into far-right groups. Other infiltration tactics were simpler. One person trained as an infiltrator and field researcher was Devin Burghardt, who today investigates right-wing fascism at the Institute for Research and Education on Human Rights.
I became involved while I was going to school up at Western Washington University. Jonathan Mazzocchi and Stephen Gardner came to do a presentation. They mentioned the fact that the organization had internships. I immediately jumped at the chance. They put me to work going to militia meetings and Klan rallies and other types of events around the region to try to gather the really important investigative research that the organization had become known for. CHD employ pretty much all of the investigative reporting techniques at our fingertips. And that includes the ability to infiltrate and go undercover at events to find out what far-right organizations are doing, to get beyond the public face that these organizations put forward, to find out what their real intentions are and what their real agendas are behind the scenes. The only way to do that is to infiltrate and go undercover. So the internship program helped train and equip me with some of the skills to be able to do some of that initial work, not the deep undercover work that's sometimes required, but the ability to go to public meetings and events and submit reports and write up about what was happening at those events to give a better sense for not only our organization, but other community organizations around the region.
What type of events that neo-Nazis hang out at? Stephen Gardner describes.
We sent people to rallies, or we went to rallies if it was a public event, or places where we knew that were not necessarily Nazi space, but where we expected to find them, punk shows, gun shows, and what came to be called preparedness expos, where survivalists gathered together to trade hints and buy mineral supplements and bayonets. People who would go to events for us, they had clean identities. They were not someone who had been published. This was a pre-internet time. So if you have a P.O. box and you're not an author or something like that, people could be pretty anonymous going to meetings and finding out what was going on directly from Nazis or from Christian patriots. There were probably another 20 to 30 people who were closely involved with us doing that from time to time.
At this point, the Coalition for Human Dignity was a busy, active organization. When Stephen talks about 20 people who operated in the capacity that Devin describes, that means 20 reports to file, 20 people to track that they got home safely, 20 people who maintained a clean identity. That's a lot, especially when we consider that intelligence was just one branch of the organization. Remember, too, the coalition supported people in deep undercover who infiltrated nationally organized neo-Nazi groups. People continue to maintain silence about that work, so there's not a lot we can tell you about it. Coalition activist Abby Layton describes how her work in the CHD was supported by the intelligence.
When we first started out, we actually had these beautiful young people who volunteered to infiltrate. There were quite a few of these brave young people, anti-racist skinheads, who infiltrated into these groups, especially Tom Metzger's group. So we had direct access the minute that there was any information, it came to us.
The Reverend Cecil Charles Prescott was one of the CHD board members back in the 1990s. He's an ordained minister in the United Church of Christ and a brother in the Order of Corpus Christi, and is currently the Director of Faith Formation at Ainsworth United Church of Christ in Portland. Here he describes how CHD's intelligence work supported community defense.
One of the strengths of the Coalition for Human Dignity was the research, which was very, very good, and at the time was rare in terms of finding accurate information, rather than, those are Nazi, we hate them. And coming to an understanding their background, who are the different players and individuals, their history, how they connect, where there are differences among those groups, and also where could you possibly find weak spots? If there were tensions between individuals, how do you work that to diffuse their power and their influence? It just occurred to me that was probably a tactic that was used in terms of knowing who these people were and how to respond to their fears and to their hopes and how to attack them differently.
Again, Devin Burkhart.
It was intense. You always have to be alert and concerned about your security and the security of others. But it was also enlightening because it really helped dispel a lot of the mythology that I think a lot of us have around neo-Nazis and far-right activists. It helps both show the human face of the other side and also introduces you, introduced me to how they interact with one another, how various factions and schisms, how they look at the opposition, how their paranoia impacts all of their activity. All of those kind of things are really illuminating to see. But what was really, I think, at the core is you really saw, once you got behind the scenes, how much race and racism and anti-Semitism really were at the core driving a lot of this stuff. Even though when they were talking to the public, they tried to often cover up or downplay that stuff. I think what was really most informative was seeing the impact that you could have of exposing what was going on behind the scenes to the larger public and being able to use that information to make a difference on what those organizations were going to do and how they were going to try to impact local communities.
Imagine the work. Activists attended meetings where they sat among the white nationalists, took notes, wrote down who was present, collected license plates, made relationships, then wrote up and submitted reports. These reports were then analyzed for commonalities.
The Coalition for Human Dignity's research arm eroded the denial and propaganda offered by the mainstream news sources. It was the CHD's goal to prove that the speeches of the white nationalists concealed a far more violent threat to peace and public safety than anyone, public or private citizen, wanted to know existed. The surveillance Devin and others provided offered a clearer proof of intent to harm. Again, here's Jonathan Mazzocchi.
We did a program of infiltration focused on the Oregon Citizens Alliance.
The Oregon Citizens Alliance was a fundamentalist anti-choice Christian group rooted in homophobia that in the early 1990s dominated Oregon Republican Party politics. The OCA represented itself as a mainstream organization within acceptable politics while legislatively dismantling human rights of queer Oregonians. The Coalition for Human Dignity toiled for years against the Oregon Citizens Alliance.
You know, the Oregon Citizens Alliance in the late 80s, they had already successfully overturned a governor's order banning discrimination in public employment. They had already succeeded in doing that by the time that they made this ballot measure statewide that would have banned LGBTQ rights within public employment. And you got to understand that, you know, on the left, among many liberals and progressives, the Christian right was often treated as something that was from the past, that we had overcome, and not politically relevant, that they were just dismissed as an irrelevant political force. Back then, we were like, no, that's not the case. These movements have always been with us. They will always be with us, and they always must be fought. We wanted to know everything about them. You do because that makes it easier to fight them.
We've heard how the intelligence was used against white nationalist movements. What tactics did the CHD use locally to expose and discourage individual racists? Here's Stephen Gardner, an anti-fascist activist, M. Trelor.
The most effective things were direct interventions. Now, that included Sharp/ARA confrontation, but it also included if they have a public event to show up with many more people than they did and confront them more rhetorically. That included outing them. This was a strategy to make them visible in the community. So to call up employers and say, look, do you know you have a Nazi working for you doing customer service who has visible swastika tattoos? Do you really want that? We had a known violent skinhead who was living in an apartment complex where there were vulnerable people. We would call up the landlord and say, look, this is a person with a history of violence. Within the applicable fair housing laws, do you really want this person living in your space? And usually what they would do is they would look at it and say, huh, this person is having a party every weekend and trashing the walls with hammer blows. Maybe we have good cause to ask them to go elsewhere. And so what happened with some of these tactics is it kept them from congregating in the city of Portland. We always tried to think, okay, who's going to be most vulnerable? And, you know, how can we do whatever it takes to move these folks away from the most vulnerable communities?
Then the other thing we did that was a little bit more controversial within the group is we said they can't hold a job. If we find out that they have a job anywhere within 50 miles, we'll show up and we'll tell their coworkers. We did that several times. So folks would call in and say, so-and-so's a Nazi and he's working here. And we'd say, okay, we'll investigate it. And it was not always true, but it was true often enough that we could say, okay, let's get together 50, 60 people and show up at the Olive Gardens and we're going to picket there. And we would have their name and, if possible, their photo on a flyer. We'd say, this is what we know about this person. He's working here. And then we would tell the manager, we're going to be here. Everybody who eats here and works here deserves to know you got a Nazi in the back room. And that drew people towards us, gave us credibility, and gave us a sense of what we're doing matters, because it did. Every time we did it, they lost their job, and I'm proud of that. It drove them out of where they were and made their lives more difficult. We would talk to them through secondary sources. We just put the word out. If you don't want this to happen, all you have to do is say, I'm no longer part of this grouping. If you drop out of this grouping, we'll leave you alone. If you stay part of this grouping, we're going to make your life hell wherever we find you. Some of them, it probably pushed them more so into the grouping, as in, everybody hates me, therefore I'm going to stick with my Nazi brothers. Many of them quit. There were 200, 300 Nazi boneheads in the area at one point, and the ones who did not go to prison drifted away. And they drifted away because their choices were either form a new tightly knit grouping or cease to be part of this so I can get on with my life. You can say there was a generational choice, but some of them, they hunkered down and eventually became Volksfront.
We debriefed people who didn't want to be Nazis anymore. So we spent a lot of time with anyone who wanted to come out, asking them, you know, why did they get in and what kinds of activities were their groups involved in it, what are your biggest concerns, and so on. And again, when it came to ex-Nazis, we were like, if you were once a Nazi, it's not enough just to say I'm no longer a Nazi. You can't be neutral in this particular fight. It's not ethically tenable. If you're going to come out, you're going to come all the way out and tell what you know.
A thorn in the side of both the CHD in general and Jonathan Mazzocchi in particular was Portland cop Lauren Christensen, a Portland Police Bureau member and a high-level influencer within the state's gang task force. Christensen was despised amongst Portland leftists as he undercut the hard work of anti-fascist groups, including the CHD, by repeatedly associating anti-racist skinheads and punks with racist skins, muddling them all together as youth gang culture rather than as specific subcultural groups. Jonathan Mazzocchi relates a personal triumph in his intelligence career.
One of the things I did personally that the Coalition for Human Dignity is not responsible for, but that I did is I managed to get a hold of Lauren Christensen's unredacted internal intelligence reports. I managed to get those over a period of, I think, 6 months or a year. And then we used that information to have a more effective means of fighting these racist groups. So these intelligence reports, so you understand, every time a cop came up upon a racist skinhead group and then interviewed them or arrested them or whatever, it would go into these summarized intelligence reports. The names, addresses, workplaces, social security, and there's just a wealth of data in there. I managed to get a steady stream of those reports. And then we used them to fight these guys. When I was stealing his reports, it also gave us a better way to contradict him in the press. When he was saying, oh, this group, they're just a bunch of kids, they're nothing. We were like, well, actually, you know, they were all at an Aryan Nations compound last weekend working with very professional neo-Nazis. That doesn't sound like wayward youth. That sounds pretty serious. So it helped us politically make our arguments also.
The research that told us that it was going to require a multiplicity of tactics, to require direct action, to require organizing to expose and confront white supremacists when they were rallying and holding public events, because that sent a message that the community wasn't going to remain silent and that Portland was no longer going to be a fertile recruiting ground for folks in the wake of white supremacist activity, that they weren't alone, that they could face the fear together. But it was really important also to expose their activities in which white supremacists were targeting for new recruits. So in essence, trying to inoculate communities that were vulnerable to white supremacist recruitment to get them to draw a bright line to exclude white supremacists from their subculture or from their organizing or from any of their other work. I think what was really important is to get more people to take it seriously. Because back then, It was really hard. It was often dismissed as local street gang activity. It was dismissed as harmless graffiti. But by doing effective and long-term research and organizing on it, you could show the larger community that this was, in fact, politically motivated, that it was designed to harass and intimidate Jews and people of color. It was designed to bring about the kind of society that white supremacists had dreamed of. And you could also then expose people to the larger networks and organizations that were providing aid and support. That was effective in getting more people to take the stuff seriously, from city government to law enforcement to everyone else. Removing it from simply a fight for the streets to making it a fight for the kind of heart and soul of the entire city.
Thanks for listening to this episode of It Did Happen Here. The transcripts, show notes with links, full credits, and other relevant content can be found at our website, itdidhappenherepodcast.com. Interviews in this episode were conducted by Annette Newell, Claire Rigetto, Selena Flores, and Aaron Yankee, and your hosts were Selena Flores and Mike Crenshaw. This podcast is produced by Mike, Selena, and me, Aaron Yankee. Thanks to the participants for sharing their stories. Thanks also to the Institute for Anarchist Studies, to PM Press, to the Marla Davis Fund, to KABU Community Radio, and to the rest of our production team, Icky A., Julie Perini, and Mo Baustern. And thank you for listening. Running in the shadows.